so we might as well get going. Just a reminder, what's happening? After today, we're going to try to wrap up the endocrine main part, and then hopefully we'll get onto some of the endocrine problems, human-related. If not to, that's up online that you can look at those PowerPoints, but I'll try to hit some of the main stuff. There's too much on that other PowerPoint details, but we're just going to kind of hit some of the main points on that. But what's going to happen on Tuesday next week? Quiz in here, right? Okay. So that's something to, and it's on endocrine. And hopefully I covered everything that's on the quiz. Okay, so this, we're a little bit behind here. We're not going to hit the, probably get onto the cardiovascular until next week, but the quiz will be on endocrine-related topics, and then we'll get into cardiovascular. And then what happens the week after that, we have the two labs, right? We have a lab on Monday and a lab on Wednesday, but in your lab protocol, there's no real lab, but we're going to use that lab time to do what? Review for the exam, right? And since the exam is on Thursday, everybody has the same opportunity to Monday and Wednesday labs, right? So no one's at a disadvantage. And we probably won't be. I'll tell you where we stop for the exam material, okay, so you'll know what's happening.
Can the students going to intern have access to that review? If we won't be here.
Yes, everything will be on audio, right? So we'll see that. When do you leave to intern? Or do you want to come on to one of the Monday sections? Can you come to any of the Monday sections?
I can send you an email.
Yeah, see what you think. And then we'll bring that up to the NCR people. I'll remind them too, because it'll be the same on the Monday classes as the Wednesday morning one, right? Okay. And then you'll have the echo by Monday for the Monday classes anyways, right? Okay, so you'll have it all ahead of time. Okay, so pay attention to your schedule. Remember, we do have labs that day. It's not that we have a wet lab, but we're going to use it as a review and then maybe cover a little bit more material. Okay, so try to catch up a little bit. Okay, so we do have labs. 1 through 4 meet on that Monday, and then, you know, the Wednesday lab will meet too. If you're going to NCR, we can try to get you in on the Monday labs section. But you probably won't stay the full 3 hours, right? But we'll cover some material. Okay, so that's that part. And where did we leave off? We left off way up here, not with insects. Okay, we left off here. Okay, so we left off covering some of the hormones, you know, some of the aspects, and we're going through systems more or less right now, and then some of the general overviews. So I know it's repeating some of the content we already went, but now putting it in a little different context. Okay, so, and I know it's a lot of material. Try to stay awake. That's why I had to get coffee this morning for myself. So I'm self asleep. There's a lot of material in here, remember, and that's why I want to have a quiz on Tuesday so that you will study and not wait till last minute, because there is so much material. But we did talk about differences of peptides and steroids for hormones. Remember, those peptide hormones, they're not going to go right across the bilipid membrane, right? But steroid molecules can go right across the bilipid membrane. And when I was a student in physiology course a long time ago, everybody said steroids only go through the cell membrane and bind to some receptor inside the cell and then initiates the process. But now we know that there are receptors on the cell surface that bind steroid hormones. So it's kind of a new thing. Older textbooks might not mention that. But generally, then, steroids can go right through cells. And you think about that, they're going through all the cells in your body. Isn't that pretty interesting to think about? You know, right on through. But then if they have the receptor in that cell, then it can initiate that response. And usually the steroid receptors will trigger some protein synthesis process, and that is going to have a long-term effect, right? It's not like just opening a channel and closing a channel. So you expect longer-term effects with steroid molecules or steroid hormones. Okay, the general idea. And then the proteins that we've mentioned that can bind to a receptor on the surface, that could initiate long-term processes, but in general, it's faster processes, and usually through a second messenger system, right? There's some exceptions to these points. But the point to also remember is some of these differences, the generalities. So, in general, there are exceptions to things, but lipid-soluble, you know, steroids, thyroid hormones, right? So going right through the cell membrane, binding to receptors inside the cell, and then you look at, they do have feedback mechanisms, but the lifetime, this is the main point to think about, you know, long-term conditions that can happen, right, from this. Usually the lipid insoluble binding to the cell surface, we're talking about real fast responses, right? Work on ion channels, or work on altering something inside the cell real quick, like calcium levels. Okay, and you know where they are. Well, we just mentioned that some of the steroids can be on the cell surface too, so remember that. And as we mentioned, they could alter gene expression levels. Okay, so can some of the other hormones, the lipid insoluble ones, depending on the mechanism. But in general, just kind of think about the general points that we mentioned about time and where the receptors are for these. All right. So there's a lot of second messenger cascades inside cells. If you had cell biology, you're probably like, oh gosh, I remember all that stuff. But the general ones that we can think about, cyclic AMP, cyclic GMP, DAD, and IP3, inositol triphosphate, and calcium. Calcium is really an amazing molecule and what it can do inside cells, and we'll look at a little bit of this. I don't want you to have to memorize every little point here, but the idea is if you had an open response question, you could say, oh, cyclic AMP can do lots of different things inside the cell. It can regulate glucogen synthesis. It can cause channels to be altered in their function, either excite them or close them, depending on the channel. The point is, cyclic AMP can then trigger the protein kinase. What do kinases do generally?
Phosphorylate.
And what does that phosphorylation do to, say, an enzyme?
It's activated.
Could activate it, could inhibit it, but conformational change, right? And then it can maybe make that enzyme active or maybe inhibit, usually activate, but there can be examples of inhibition. Right, so protein kinases, phosphorylation, change. Remember that very first lecture when we talked about ATP? Why is ATP an energy molecule? You know, if you had ATP right there, what does it do? It phosphorylates, like the pump, right? And then it can be active. So the idea, same idea. Okay, so the point here is, depending on the cell, you can have a lot of different type of processes going on. It depends what protein kinase is going to work on, the enzymes in that cell, right? That cell might be more for glycogen regulation, or it might be affected more by ion channels. So it depends, just like we talked about with neurotransmitters. It's the receptors, it's what the cell cascade is going to have inside, that's where you get the variation. But what's really quite interesting is look at the top part. You have, and if you had cell, you probably cover this a lot more, but the general point here is that you can have receptors that are stimulatory to the enzyme analyte cyclase or inhibitory to analyte cyclase. So they call these GS and GI, these G-coupled proteins. So you might hear G-coupled proteins. There's, you know, textbooks on G-coupled proteins. There's so much to this. But the main point is that you can have stimulatory G-coupled proteins and you can have inhibitory G-coupled proteins. What they can do is to alter analyte cyclase activity, either make cyclic AMP or decrease the production of cyclic AMP. And then that regulates this cascade on down with protein kinase. So I know it's a lot there, but the general points, what do you have to remember? You can have stimulation or inhibition of analyte cyclase. That can alter the cyclic AMP levels, and then that can alter many things inside the cell, right? That could be increase their phosphorylation or decrease their phosphorylation. Decrease it, you might be turning off enzymes. Or you might be increasing phosphorylation, you can turn on enzymes. So you can change how that cell functions. And then that can have long-term consequences too. That's why I meant that when you talk about lipid insoluble ones when we think of like that table that was only fast, but you can see that now you could have, you know, really long-term consequences as well. Okay. So that's the main idea there. Okay, so this is just kind of blown out parts. Just what we talked about, the phosphorylation and cellular responses and aspects on analyte cyclase. Okay, so if we think about cyclic AMP, and there's just tons of things cyclic AMP does, but some of the hormones that work through cyclic AMP processes, epinephrine, thyroid hormone, vasopressin or ADH, antidiuretic hormone, glucagon, serotonin, probably won't talk too much about prostaglandins, but that's important too, and even inhibitory. So here you have epinephrine, like we mentioned a long time ago, with the sympathetic system, alpha 2, and beta receptors. So we have epinephrine doing two different things. It's based on the receptors, right? So if you had more alpha 2 receptors in one spot versus beta receptors, you get opposite response. This is what I mentioned a long time ago that was really confusing to people when they injected epinephrine into animal models. Sometimes they would see vasoconstriction, and other places they could see vasodilation, and they were like, what's going on, right? And so until they figured out that there's different receptors, but the activator could be the same thing. Epinephrine can work differently depending on the cell's receptors. So finally they worked that out, and that's really quite interesting. If you ever get a chance to take a pharmacology course, I really encourage it. You'll learn so much physiology in a pharmacology course, probably more physiology in a pharmacology course than in a physiology course, because they really get down to mechanisms of action, so you really learn quite a bit. Okay, so the idea here is that cyclic AMP is used in a lot of different processes depending on the activator and that cell response. Okay. And the take-home of a lot of this second messenger is that you amplify those signals. So you have maybe a few receptors on the cell surface that are activated, but if you activate a whole bunch of cascades in the cell, you've amplified that response, right? And you can then maybe turn on 100 enzymes or have that enzyme turned on for a long period of time, and then, but you've only activated a few receptors on the surface. So it's a real amplification process. Don't worry about memorizing numbers here. It's just that it can be amplified quite a bit. And in some cases, they say maybe a millionfold amplification. Here, it's a 10,000, you know, molecules turned on. The general idea is, depends on the cell, but that you amplify these signals by activating these processes inside the cell. And we'll go through a little bit more on that in a second. So this is kind of interesting, too. This is another process. Instead of analyte cyclase, phospholipase C. And you might have heard that in some other classes, but now we can put it in context. So here we could have this particular phospholipase C. When it's activated, it can actually split into two aspects, DAG and IP3. What's interesting about DAG state, maybe the next figure will be a little easier. Yeah, this is a little easier. We'll come back to the other one. DAG stays in the membrane, cis membrane bound, but it can actually work on receptors and cause changes to happen on the membrane. IP3 is soluble in solution, and in the cell, it can actually move around in the cytosol, and it can work on the endoplasmic reticulum, and cause calcium to come out. So once calcium comes out, that can do lots of things. I know this is a little complicated, but we'll go through it again. So IP3 can move in the cytoplasm, work on the ER, cause calcium to come out. Now you can see that calcium, when it comes out, depending on the cell, you can have lots of different responses. But that calcium can activate what's called calcium calmodulin kinase, and kinase is a phosphorylation process. What's interesting is it can activate itself, and so it can actually be like a positive feedback. And now that response can cause lots of things to happen. The take home here is that here you have something that stays in the membrane when you activate phospholipase C, like some kind of G-coupled protein, again, activates phospholipase C. Depending on that cell, there's some channel that might be altered by DAG that could have a response. But maybe that cell is responsive inside to calcium. And if you trigger calcium release from the ER, then you get a different response. So if you look at old exams, some of the open response questions is, why does cell A have a different response than cell B for the same hormone and the same concentration of that hormone? what would you say? Receptor density on the cell membrane might be the same, but depending on the cascades that are, you know, altered in that cell, you could get different responses, right? And you might have a response that would go through calcium calmodulin kinase, or maybe DAG. In some cases, you might open a channel or close a channel. In other ones, you might turn on some other enzymes. So the idea is just you can get lots of responses. It's real hard to just say you're going to get one thing, okay? And the idea is that IP3 is soluble. All right, so we can go back to this. This is why this figure is sometimes a little confusing, because it makes it makes you think that DAG moves around in the cytoplasm, but it can stay on stays on the plasma membrane. But you see that calcium can trigger lots of different things, right? So calcium, you know, in the muscle cell, right? We've talked about troponin C, for example. In different cells, it might even activate different types of kinases, such as this protein kinase G. We won't talk about it, but you have many different kind of kinases in cells, and those could be activated differently. Okay. So hopefully it's not too confusing. They might look confusing at the beginning, but you get the general point. That's the main thing. And calcium, as we mentioned, just is, can do so many things, right? Depending on the cell, you might get different responses. We know how calcium is important in neurotransmission, right? Calcium for skeletal muscle, but calcium for other cells, very important for regulating many different processes. So we get the idea. A lot there. Yes?
Do we need to know the different pathways that you had on the slide, or is that just examples?
No, just, you mean like this?
Yeah, in the previous.
No, I mean just the general idea is the amplification. But one can trigger the next one. Like, if you had phospholipase C, IP3 could be released, and then that could trigger calcium from the cell store, and then that calcium could come out and then trigger calcium calmodulin, that kind of idea, okay? And so you might even have calcium released from two types of cells, A and B, but maybe if you don't have calcium calmodulin so much in one cell, then you don't get as big of a response. Does that answer your question? Okay. And I know it's a lot, but it's the same kind of idea over and over again, just to kind of push that point. But remember that calcium inside the cell, other enzymes don't know, or calcium calmodulin doesn't know that that calcium was released from internal stores, or maybe came from external aspects. So it could come from opening a calcium channel and activating. So maybe cell A and cell B gets a different level of calcium entry because you've opened up a calcium channel in this case, but you didn't open a calcium channel here, but it had the same, you know, enzyme action on the receptors. So you could have this additive effect. That's kind of where we're going with this. So it's really complicated if you get down to mechanisms. And this is kind of the fun aspect if you take a pharmacology. Anybody take intro pharm here yet? They offered a new course last year. Did you take it? No? They're having two levels of pharmacology course for undergraduates now, an intro one, a 200 level, and then a more advanced one. And I think those are really be good courses to take in time. If you're not graduating or if you've still got another year, you might think about a pharmacology course because they're really quite interesting. Some people applying to the pharmacy program? No? No one's applying to the pharmacy program. They've got a great program here. Okay, yes. So we've had students that have gone into the program there. They said they really enjoyed it, and you learn quite a bit of these kind of mechanisms. It's really interesting. Okay, so that was the main point with that. It's just an example, like atrial natriuretic peptide that we've talked about. So a peptide binds to this receptor, and then it can alter cyclic GMP levels, and then that causes a difference in how that cell responds. Just differences, again, to emphasize that point, not to memorize all the different receptors here. But we did mention before, again, it's the receptor. So here's an example of serotonin. Remember, serotonin, the same molecule, but depending on the cell, you have somewhere around 14 different types, 13 to 14 different types of serotonin receptors in your body. And they can do different things. So serotonin is not only always excitatory or inhibitory, it depends on that cell. The idea is that these different receptors can cause different aspects. So here we see GI, inhibitory, GS, and another one called GQ. GQ can alter ion channels, how they work, but also works through phospholipase C. So these G-coupled proteins, there's just three listed here, inhibitory, stimulatory, and Q, and you can see that the inhibitory and stimulatory work on analyte cyclase, that enzyme. Here's that GQ that works on phospholipase C that we talked about, making either DAG, stays in the membrane, or IP3, that can then work inside the cell and cause the calcium release. So people are interested in serotonin in particular. Why might these people interested in serotonin? The happy drug, right? You know, the antidepressant and anxiety. So people take compounds that alter the serotonin levels, basically by maybe even blocking the transport of the reuptake of serotonin. You hear a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRIs. And if you had more serotonin around, that can then alter these responses. But it's really known that it can also alter in time the receptor expression level of these receptors. So that's important too. And that's why it takes so long, for like 2 weeks, for SSRIs to really work, because you're actually changing receptor expression levels. If you wanted, if it was just the SSRI action by itself, LSD does that, right? LSD will actually cause serotonin levels to be high in the synaptic cleft, and that response is in, you know, minutes to hours. But then SSRIs like Prozac isn't just working by that mechanism. It's actually working by altering receptor expression levels on the cell that's releasing serotonin, autoreceptors, as well as target receptors. So it's kind of interesting. There's a lot of information that's still coming out about actually how these SSRIs are working, but you get the idea. It's not so simple. It's not, you know, straightforward. And that's why people need to be careful coming off of SSRIs. If you come off cold turkey, that's really bad news, because you can have some real psychiatric problems because the receptors haven't regulated back to their natural state again. So that's why they wean them off of that little by little. Okay, so some fun things. Adrenal glands, and I know I just have to go through these different systems, so I'm going to try to keep it going. And I know it's like schizophrenia up here. But now if we talk about the adrenal glands, it's really an amazing tissue, as we mentioned before, because why? You have the adrenal medulla that comes from neural endocrine cells, you know, migrates to this region, and then you have the adrenal cortex, the tissue in embryology, great course if you ever get a chance to take it. Then the cells migrate around the adrenal medulla, and the cortex and the medulla are different, right? And what they release are different. But they release their compounds into the bloodstream, which is really quite neat. All right. And some of the actions, look at this too, is that, you know, if we have an arterial supply, blood comes in, maybe the hormone that stimulates the adrenal cortex, pretty interesting. And then that can be released and go right to the venous system and work back on the targets that it's going to work on. And the adrenal medulla, if it's releasing epinephrine, then it's getting to the body pretty quickly, can alter heart rate, for example, things like that. Okay, so pretty neat. Right about your kidneys. That's why when you get an injury in the back, not only do you might have kidney problems, but you might actually have adrenal problems. What's really kind of neat, too, is some people have these epinephrine surges or hormonal imbalance, and it might be related to the adrenal glands. So you can have ectopic, means not in the normal place, ectopic location of the adrenal medulla and adrenal cortex. In development, they don't migrate to the right locations, and they might migrate to a different part in your body, and sometimes those become tumors, and they secrete at a higher level. Most tumors are not regulated by negative feedback processes, so you get more production, and it's not turned off. They're not receptive to the negative feedback in majority of cases. So that's kind of interesting to think about. Some people have developmental problems, and they know it might be related to the adrenal cortex or adrenal medulla, and then they try to find out if you have ectopic placement of these tissues in development. And so that's kind of neat to think about. Okay, so as we talk about metabolic and developmental hormones, it looks like a lot, but we've already covered this, and so it's just kind of putting it in a category of metabolic and developmental groups, okay? So glucagon and insulin for glucose regulation. But if we think about glucagon, where do they come from? Alpha cells. Glucagon how to remember this, so you'll remember it for any standardized exams or later on. Gluc a gon, right? Gluc a alpha cells, all right? Insulin in the beta cells. So gluc a gon alpha cells. And that has appeared on standardized exams before, too. So you'll remember this then. And what does glucagon do? It raises glucose levels. Okay, raises glucose levels. Insulin gets the glucose to go into the cells. So what's it going to do to the blood glucose? Drop it down, right? Because it's going into cells. Cortisol, we mentioned, is really important in glucocorticoids from adrenal cortex, right? Adrenal cortex. And what can they do? They're to handle your stress. So like getting up in the morning, or if you get stressed. So what do you want to do if you're stressed? You want glucose levels. You want to mobilize the glucose levels. You want to raise it up in the body. Just handle that stress so you can then get it into tissues. So you can either turn on protein synthesis or get ready to run or whatever it might be. And so it's going to raise blood glucose levels. What's going to happen if blood glucose levels go up? Well, insulin then is going to kick in and try to get it into the cells, right? It doesn't do any good just to raise blood glucose levels. You've got to get it into the cells too. So you can imagine this kind of stair-step approach. And then insulin, then glucose drops, and then what happens? Oh, well, I'm too low on glucose, you've got to raise it back up, so glucagon gets stimulated. So you see, it's always going on. It's continuous, right? So kind of get the main points here. And then growth hormone, just as you would imagine, growth of tissues, growth of the body, it's going to do what? Increase protein production. How do you do that? Well, you've got to stimulate RNA, right, to then have RNA synthesis to make those proteins. So it seems pretty logical. You don't have to try to just memorize everything, but it, you know, if you kind of logically go through it, I think it will fall in place. There are lots to memorize. I do know that. I mean, where it comes from and how it works, like growth hormone from the anterior pituitary. Okay, so a few more of these hormones. We just talked about insulin from beta cells, right? Gets glucose into the cells. And epinephrine, we've mentioned that multiple times, adrenal medulla, right? And what does epinephrine do? Think of sympathetic nervous system, right? Increase heart rate. Again, to handle stress, for example, you might mobilize glucose. Thyroxine, the thyroid hormones, you know, from the thyroid. And then thyroid is really important to control metabolism. Right? We mentioned about people with hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism. If you're hypothyroid, you might be cold all the time. Your metabolism's down. You don't have energy. You feel lethargic. If you have high Th, T4, then you might be more energetic, and you might feel hot all the time, right? So this is part of that aspect as well. And then you need T3, T4 for developmental aspects. If you don't have thyroid hormone, you won't develop well. Your muscles won't develop. They don't differentiate. And this is throughout pretty much all the vertebrate world. Okay. So it's pretty neat to think about. We talked about that really neat aspect where they could transplant the adrenal medulla into the brain, right? Before, about curing Parkinson's, for example. Now people are trying to culture adrenal medulla type of cells so they can actually implant these into animals. In animal models, it's been working pretty well. But the idea is that stem cells might be able to actually help cure Parkinson's, for example. But it's because in the process, in your adrenal gland, making epinephrine, you go through that step of making dopamine. And in Parkinson's, it's the lack of the dopamine. So if they can keep this being produced, then you can actually help with the Parkinson's. But the idea again here is you see how efficient it is by working with amino acid or tyrosine, for example, and you can either make dopamine. If another cell has a few more enzymes, then it can go on to epinephrine, norepinephrine, or epinephrine. And so that's pretty neat. It's just like inside your brain, you have transmitted three GABA or glutamate. But your GABAergic neurons just have one more enzyme, a glutamate decarboxylase. And that converts glutamate into GABA. Isn't that pretty cool? So, you know, you could have these two cells, they both make glutamate, but this one has another enzyme, and it makes GABA. So pretty efficient, you know, in the way it works. That's pretty cool. And we've talked about adrenal gland in sympathetic systems. So that remember that adrenal gland is like a postganglionic target tissue, right? Okay. We've already talked about this. So one kind of last part about wrapping up on some of these aspects with the hormones. Remember, we talked about cholesterol is important. So when people say, don't have any cholesterol, you need cholesterol. Helps with your bilipid membranes, but also it's a precursor to steroid hormones like progesterone. And that progesterone gets converted to different types of other molecules like cortisol or other aspects. And that then, as we go to androstenedione, that can be converted to estrone, testosterone, estradiol. So you get the idea that females go through this process too to make estradiol, but if there's some enzyme problems, then you might have more testosterone than you do estradiol. So that's really quite interesting to think about. And at that point, I wanted to jump over to this other slide. Let me see what's next here. Okay, we can jump to this other part. I've tried to pull it up online. Kind of neat. So in sex differentiation, thinking about these hormones and development, just that we're kind of aware of these different issues. And since we're all in this physiology course. So early on in development, it's really quite neat, and it works with this mammalian inhibitory factor that we're going to talk about. As you develop as a fetus, you are indifferentiated sexually. And depending on the hormones, you either develop male characteristics or female characteristics. But those tissue types are analogous between the two. So you get the idea, male and female parts, right? And then if you think about how does this develop differently, it's all based on the hormones. And so I'll give you these websites, or I'll put them on the line too, because it's kind of helpful. But then we can understand developmental differences. So here's your sexually indifferent stage. Can you see that okay? And you have these two different general ducts called the Mullerian duct and the Wolferian duct. And the Wolferian duct for the male aspects and the Mullerian duct for the female aspects. Maybe think of a wolf as male. Maybe that would help in some aspects. Okay, so depending on the hormones that are released, you either go through and stimulate these cell types that we talked about a little bit before in the gonads for the male, Sertoli cells and Leydig cells. Sertoli cells are really quite interesting because they make this inhibitory factor. And the Mullerian ducts degenerate if the Sertoli cells are working. They can actually degenerate the Mullerian duct. So then the female part goes away. The Leydig cells are making the testosterone that then helps with the Wolferian duct to be developed. And that's important because that develops the parts that go around the testes and helps with sperm production. The female, they don't have Leydig or Sertoli cells, so you don't have the inhibitory factor. And you're not making the testosterone, so the Wolferian ducts aren't maintained. And so they degenerate. So this is kind of interesting. So it's kind of a default process to go through and keep the Mullerian ducts developing. And those turn into the fallopian tubes in the uterus and the upper part of the vagina. So that's really quite interesting. There are lots of different disorders out there. And you might have heard of some of these. And this is why sometimes you hear crazy politicians say certain things, but they don't understand that some people might have hormonal problems and they need some extra care taking care of them. But you can have these androgen insensitivity syndrome. It's not that they don't make the androgen. It's not that they don't make testosterone. They might not have the receptor for it. So that's kind of interesting to think about. They might be having normal testosterone levels, but they don't have the receptor for it. So then they don't get the response. I think I mentioned before, didn't I mention about the 5-alpha reductase, right? And Dominion Republic, where the boys grow up as girls, and then they develop as a basically as a girl, but then in secondary, when they reach puberty, they start to have a little bit of the testosterone, and then all of a sudden they realize, oh, I got facial hair and muscles growing, and then they realize, oh, maybe there's an issue. So they check them out, and it depends. The family and the child then has to figure out, do they want to go as a male or do they want to go as a female? But they've been raised to this puberty stage basically sometimes as a female. So it's really, you can imagine the psychology behind all this too. So kind of interesting. On this website, it's a nice little quiz. Hint, hint. Nice little quiz on this website. So I'll give you this website. Okay, so this will be kind of fun. Now we might not see too much of this on Tuesday, but you might see it later. All right. So that's kind of neat to think about. All right, and so I thought that was kind of neat to talk about. All right. So if we go back to these hormones in general, and we think about, like we've mentioned before, hormones that might be regulated with circadian patterns or stress, like we mentioned, cortisol goes up early in the morning, it goes up again in the afternoon. That can help regulate your glucose levels or your stress levels. So that's kind of neat, those glucocorticoids being activated. But then if you raise glucose levels, you're going to have some negative feedback processes, so think about all that. And then what that can do in the tissues. So, such as stress levels, right? Glucocorticoids, raising the glucose levels, but they can actually degenerate over time your muscles. So constant stress can actually, if you're trying to raise your glucose levels, remember way back when we talked about cell metabolism and we talked about making ATP, we had three aspects. We had proteins that can be broken down to amino acids, right? They can enter the TCA cycle. We have carbohydrates like glycogen to glucose, right through glycolysis TCA cycle. And then what else did we have? The fatty acid cycle, right, that can go to acetyl-CoA, and then that can go to the TCA cycle and make ATP. So these can be stimulated, and over time, if you're really trying to keep doing that all the time, glucocorticoids can be damaging the sense of the skeletal muscle to degrade that, and you can actually get loss of your skeletal muscle. So that's not good. And then you can always mobilize fat, right? And then trying to get gluconeogenesis, new glucose from stores that are in the liver, for example, and kind of going through glycolysis in reverse, kind of. Right? So that's kind of neat. We mentioned thyroid hormones before. I don't want you to have to. There's some in some textbooks that go a little bit more about T3 and T4, but if you ever get a blood test for thyroid, they'll actually use a ratio of T3 to T4, and that's important because you might have higher T3 levels, might not be converted to T4, so they always want to work on a ratio to see how you're producing T4. But the active ingredient then here for these hormones is usually T4 on the target tissue, and that can stimulate development, metabolism of the cell. And we talked about iodine before. That's really important. And you might have seen people with the lack of iodine. We'll talk about that in the next PowerPoints. So kind of neat. Thyroid hormone, how is it actually regulated? So these are one of these standardized type of test questions. The hypothalamus releases what? Thyroid-releasing hormone. That thyroid-releasing hormone goes to the anterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary releases thyroid-stimulating hormone. Thyroid-stimulating hormone to the thyroid tissue to release from the thyroid hormones. And then you have the negative feedback, not only to the anterior pituitary, but also to the hypothalamus. So pretty neat on the regulations. So when people have a disorder, they want to know, is it the thyroid gland? Is it the anterior pituitary? Is it the hypothalamus? You know, where could that problem be? And then, as we mentioned, thyroid is very important for regulating lots of tissues in your body, in development as well as maintenance. All right, so the two main hormones for glucose with the pancreas, glucagon and insulin, right? What cells does glucagon come from? Alpha cells. Got that down. All right, so, and then beta cells for insulin. And so we've gone through this quite a bit already about regulating glucose. Try to get the general points down here. But also, don't forget, other hormones regulate glucose levels, right? Like growth hormone, glucocorticoids, cortisol, right? So don't just think about insulin or glucagon. Standardized exams sometimes don't give you that choice, and you're like confused because insulin's not on the chart, and you think, oh my gosh, what happened? Or glucagon, they might be mentioning cortisol, right? And so remember that these other hormones are important too. All right, and that's the same process that we just talked about. So regulating water balance, I know we didn't get to the renal system yet, but we will, and we'll go over some of those hormones again. But in general, we've already talked about these. And we've talked about ADH, antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin. Remember where it comes from. Only two hormones for the posterior pituitary, oxytocin and vasopressin, also known as ADH. Almost every year, without failure, there'll be somebody coming back on an exam that says, but it was ADH, but you said vasopressin. It's the same thing, right? So you're going to have to remember this, the same things. Okay, so posterior pituitary, anti-diuresis. So what does that mean? Less diuresis, less pee, production, urine production, right? So what does that relate to? Increased water reabsorption. We'll get to how that works on the kidneys later on, but we did mention it would stimulate esophophorins to then help with reabsorption. This was really cool, as I mentioned before, atrial peptide, that it actually comes from the heart. When you overstretch the atrium, it's released, and then that can actually says, oh, my body has too much fluid in it, it's too much pressure in my atrium. It can actually reduce the sodium reabsorption, so you're going to pee more to reduce your blood volume so you don't stretch the atrium as much. So it's pretty neat to think about how that process all works. Calcitonin and the other hormone, we should probably put these two together to think about calcitonin and parathyroid. Remember, they're both from tissues around the thyroid, parathyroid glands, like we mentioned, the pairs, and then the thyroid. And what do? Parathyroid increases calcium levels, and it can do it in lots of different ways. One way is really intestinal absorption of calcium. Isn't that pretty cool? Increases calcium absorption from your GI tract. And calcitonin decreases blood calcium levels, because what does it do? It increases, it can actually increase bone absorption and calcium to go into the bone. So how to remember this one? Calcitonin. Calcitonin, tone for the bone, right? So increase that calcium in the bone. That might be a good way to try to remember that one. And then you think of the other hormone, parathyroid hormone, that can, if you're increasing calcium in the bone, what's going to happen to the blood calcium levels? It's going to go down. It's kind of like insulin, right? And if you break down bone, then calcium levels are going to go up. That's parathyroid. Okay, so that might help in that aspect. There's some little subtleties there, but the general idea, that's the way to memorize it for your standardized exams too. And that's really important, right? Because if you break your arm, break your bone, you want your bone to be able to turn over, right? And you want it to be able to repair. So that repair process, breaking down some calcium and putting it back, that's really important for bone repair as well. There's a lot there, I know. Adrenal cortex, we've covered that quite a bit already, and we'll go into it a little bit more. But the mineral corticoids, one in particular, there's a couple, but the one in particular is aldosterone that we should remember. Remember, what else comes from the adrenal cortex? Glucocorticoids, cortisol. But this one we're talking about mineral balance, so aldosterone. Aldosterone works on the kidneys to promote sodium reabsorption. And what's going to happen if you have sodium reabsorption? Water follows. It increases your blood volume and increases your blood pressure. All right. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. So we've already talked about calcium and parathyroid hormone and calcitonin, and the main idea of calcitonin and how that can increase calcium to actually go into the bone, more or less, and parathyroid hormone to raise calcium levels. Okay, so now we get into a little bit of the reproductive hormones. We've covered a lot of these already, so we don't have to go into so much point. We've talked about oxytocin, what it already does, posterior pituitary. We didn't talk too much about prolactin yet, but you get the idea of lactation, prolactin. So it increases milk production in the females to then help with breastfeeding, for example, or milk for the baby. But also during puberty, this can actually be increased in males too. So you might actually hear about males, maybe in high school, that could be embarrassing for a boy, right? That they actually might produce some milk from their breast as well because this hormone is increasing, and then it regulates out. So that's kind of an interesting point to think about. But, you know, teachers are sometimes taught about hormones, and so it's important to understand about all that. The sex hormones, estrogens, progesterone, and testosterone, we need to know where these hormones come from. Testosterone, we mentioned a bit. lighting cells, but also some from the adrenal cortex. So that's kind of interesting to think about. And progesterone, not just the corpus luteum, but also from the adrenal cortex. So that's kind of neat to think about too, right? So if you had an adrenal tumor, what could you be making? You could be making a lot of other hormones from your adrenal cortex, like the glucocorticoids and the mineralocorticoids, but you might be making a lot of progesterone. So it's interesting to think about the differences that might happen. And then estrogens, we'll talk a little bit more about that, corpus luteum, but also the adrenal cortex. And we've already mentioned the steroids, and then we got to think about how they work. All right. So I think we can go through some of these a little bit as we go along. So definitely, you want to know about the male and the female differences. And as I mentioned before, sometimes it gets a little confusing about LH and FSH. But gonadotropin-releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, right, produced in the hypothalamus through the bloodstream that goes right next to the anterior pituitary, triggers those to release LH and FSH. Remember, in the female, follicle-stimulating hormone stimulates the follicle. But think of the analogous counterpart in the male. It's going to stimulate then what? Follicle stimulate, then in the male, sperm production. So follicle and sperm. So in the male, it's going to work to increase sperm production. Luteinizing hormone in the female enhances the corpus luteum. And then that can make progesterone, for example. So LH in the male then can work on the testes to then increase testosterone production. So think of the analogous system. And then you can relate to the secondary sexual characteristics, muscle development, and then also negative feedback processes. In the female, it can be a bit more complicated and because of the estrous cycle. And if you ever get a chance, if anybody animal science major? Animal science major? Yes. Did you have the course? There's a whole course in reproductive endocrinology and animal sciences, and they go through a whole semester just of this. And you realize how important it is because of food production, right? And how often you can have estrus in different animals for producing the next offspring. So it's really quite interesting. And different animals have different cycles of estrus, not just, you know, monthly, but different types of animals with different cycles. So we're not going to get into all that. We're going to stick mostly with the human mammal. But again, the same idea. Gonadotropin-releasing hormone to the anterior pituitary, FSH, and LH. It's a little bit easier to understand in the female, in the sense that follicle stimulates the follicle. LH stimulates the corpus luteum. The point to remember is the corpus luteum produces the progesterone and estrogens. Then that's high, and then that actually can help with secondary sexual characteristics along with estrogen, but progesterone can also do other aspects, like if you're pregnant, then it helps to maintain the mammary glands in maintenance as well. And again, feedback processes. But there's so much to this, right, in the cycles. We don't have to get too crazy with it, but I want you to understand some of these processes because it's important to think about. Now, I know this is a lot, and males are probably very confused by the whole thing, but females might have this down a little bit more. But we do got to know about this. So how to remember some of these cycles and which hormones are going up when? I think it's the easiest thing to think about the very beginning, right after menses. And I've had people on exams, and it was a female that asked what menses is. This is your period, right? So menses, the sloughing of the lining. Okay, so what's happening right at the end of menses? This is the time that estrogen's low, progesterone's low, and then you start this proliferative phase. So you're rebuilding up the tissue. And if you're rebuilding up this tissue, it needs hormones to maintain that. So here's your hormones. Estrogen is important for development of this endometrial lining of the tissue. And that's going to actually stimulate this tissue to grow. It also can do some other things. But the general idea is, we'll talk about this, increasing this tissue to develop. What's regulating the follicle is this whole follicle stage before it erupts, before it ovulation occurs. So ovulation is when the egg or the follicle bursts open and it released. So they call this the follicular phase, the follicle phase. When the Follicles released, that's ovulation. So ovulation is right when the follicle is released. Okay. So what happens with the follicle? If it gets fertilized, then it can be implanted. And you have a nice tissue developed with a lot of vascularization that can help for this implantation. What happens after the ovulation phase when the follicle is ovulated? When this follicle is released, the corpus luteum will start to develop a little bit. And this development, when it starts to enhance in its growth, it's going to produce progesterone. So the corpus luteum is secreting progesterone. And depending on the level of the progesterone and estrogen, then that can actually trigger, if there's no implantation, it can trigger the period to begin again. So you start to get the sloughing and menses. Then the whole cycle goes over. What's happening down here? If you see the estrogen level and progesterone level, so look over here. The top line is the estrogen. The bottom one's the progesterone. What's happening with the follicular phase? Key point to remember, estrogen rises, and then when that estrogen peaks, pretty much that's when you have ovulation. All right. When the corpus luteum's developing, you're getting progesterone now to be enhanced during this luteal phase. Remember, this is called luteal phase because the corpus luteum's developing. Then the progesterone's enhanced, and estrogen has some rise as well. But the big peak of estrogen is during the follicular phase that helps with the rupture of the follicle, and the luteal phase is progesterone when the corpus luteum is really enlarging. And then you get menses. Now, the rest of this cycle over here is if it's fertilized and you get implantation, what does this tissue do? It actually secretes chorionic gonadotropin. This is the pregnancy test. So you can actually test for secretion of chorionic gonadotropin. What does chorionic gonadotropin do? It feeds back on the corpus luteum to maintain progesterone secretion. If that progesterone secretion is enhanced, then it maintains the intermediate ventral lining to maintain the egg, the fertilized egg, so then you can grow the whole little fetus. Okay, I know that's complicated. But think about then how to promote the corpus luteum to continue developing. Well, it's under the hormones that we talked about before, like LH. So look at LH surging at this time, and that's going to then work to do what? Work on the luteum, the corpus luteum, to maintain that tissue so it can secrete progesterone. So I think it's easier to think about the follicular phase and corpus luteum phase. Think of those hormones, and then you think, step back, and you think, well, what maintains the corpus luteum? Well, that's the LH, so you have the surge of LH to help produce the corpus luteum to maintain its cycle. And follicle, when the follicle is going to go into ovulation when it ruptures, then you have that surge of FSH. And they tried to make it show it that it's a little bit before ovulation, because that surge in FSH will then cause the follicle to then be released. So follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, and then think about what it does to the follicle and the corpus luteum. A little complicated, I know, but try to think about, you know, if you draw this out, the best thing is to take a blank piece of paper and I think work out this first part of the 29 days and then work your way back to the FSH and LH, and then you can think about, well, what's being produced by these two structures, the follicle and the kind of early corpus luteum, estrogen, and but after the corpus luteum, progesterone, and then that fits well with the cycles down here. So one other thing I wanted to mention, it's on this power on the slide I pulled up. Okay, so menstrual cycle. Here we go. So this figure, I'll put this web link up there too. It's the same thing again. It's the endometrial lining that we were talking about. But here's the follicle, so this is ovulation, right? Right here. Now this one is a little bit crazy in the sense that it shows this peak a little bit different than the other one. But the idea is that estrogen and progesterone being released. Progesterone, after the estrogen surges and progesterone starts to rise too, body temperature changes. So some females monitor their cycle by body temperature. And by using the temperature method, they can see when's the best time maybe for fertilization, when's the best time to become pregnant. And, you know, you cycle with this. And some people use birth control as this temperature control too. And there's lots of babies born when people use this as a regulator for birth control. But some people use this as a natural kind of process of knowing when you won't get the best, when you won't get implantation is when the sloughing occurs, right? When you're having menses. So you can actually think about, if you time your cycle right, when menses occurs, you're going to have less likely for implantation, so then it won't, it's the best time to, I guess, have sex, and then you won't have be pregnant. But that doesn't work all the time, so there's lots of babies that are born from using the temperature method. But it is kind of interesting that this raises and lowers. So, birth control pills. What's in a birth control pill? It doesn't mean that you're on it, but some people might be able to answer what's in the birth control pill. Progesterone and maybe a little bit of estrogen, too. Depends. Who do we have to thank for developing the birth control pill? The Puerto Ricans. A lot of Puerto Ricans. Because these companies actually use the Puerto Ricans to sign up on paper for a test, the birth control pregnancies. And they're going to try this out. But what they gave them initially on was a lot of estrogen. And a lot of that estrogen that they were on caused what? Cancers. They got a lot of uterine cancers. They got breast cancers. But they signed the waivers so they didn't have to collect any money from the pharmaceutical companies. They used the Puerto Ricans basically to develop the pill that we use today. And a lot of people got cancer from it. A lot of Puerto Ricans developed cancer. And they didn't get any compensation for this at all. It wasn't, I think, until when Carter was stepping out, he finally recognized at a level that, hey, we did something bad, you know. But they signed their papers. It's kind of like coal miners in eastern Kentucky signing over their land or coal, and then they find out their whole land all around their little house sitting up on a hill is the only thing left. Right, so taking advantage of the people, and some of them, they went in, found out they didn't even speak English, they couldn't even read the contract that they signed, but they got money to do this and then have birth control. So bad history with that, but it's kind of interesting. But so you can thank the Puerto Ricans really for dedicating to develop the birth control pill, which has more progesterone in it now than estrogen, but the early ones had a high estrogen level and caused lots of problems. So, you know, about the, we're not going to get into birth control pills and how everything works, but the idea is that if you have this higher progesterone levels, you can't really maintain then the normal cycle. It's a feedback process, and then you won't get that implantation to maintain. Okay, so that's that part. Okay, we got a few more minutes. So I know there's a lot to this. It's complicated. But just real quick, I just want to mention a little bit about some insect hormones, because it is parasitology. We won't get too crazy about it. You can have a whole course just on insect hormones, which are really important for development. But the history of it was much like we started off with this chapter, taking the testes, right, from a rooster that has been castrated, and then putting testes in, and then seeing, oh, it starts to develop, knowing that it was in the blood. Well, they did these really neat experiments, too, by using like a glass tube between parts of the larvae, for example, or pupa, and actually seeing how that changes development. In this case, they're taking pupa 1 and pupa 2 at different stages and seeing how that can alter the other one. The point, the take-home here is blood-borne substances in the hemolymph, right? Transferring from one to the other. And then thinking about what tissue does that hormone come from, which is really important in insect development or insect regulation. So I don't want to get too crazy with this, but two hormones that we should know about is JH and ecdysone. JH is standing for juvenile hormone, and ecdysone for ecdysis. It comes from this part in the brain, so again, a neuroendocrine for prothoracic hormone, and this then works on this thoracic gland to make ecdysone. But alpha-ecdysone is not active by itself. It actually has to work on some tissue in the target, and then that tissue, like the cuticle, can actually make beta-ecdysone. And beta-ecdysone is the active form of ecdysone. It's really quite neat because you can actually have fly mutants that don't make ecdysone, and they stay as a larvae for a much longer period of time, and you get kind of giant larvae. So that's kind of neat. Juvenile hormone is what stays as a juvenile, but there's some interesting aspects to this. And then there's this eclosion hormone. When you have a pupa, it has to eclose out, right, and become the butterfly or moth adult form. And so that hormone rises to then come out of that pupa case. So that's kind of neat, too. It's from the neural tissue. Beta ecdysone is a steroid molecule, and juvenile hormone isn't that steroid shape. But here's kind of the take-home to think about this. Juvenile hormone concentration, to stay as a juvenile in the larvae stage, it's really high. When it drops, then it actually will start to form a pupa. And for some odd reason, they don't really understand it that well, but it goes back up as an adult stage again. But what's really interesting is juvenile hormone drops, and ecdysone, which isn't drawn on this, starts to rise, and that's what then makes the pupa. So people use ecdysone in insecticides, for example, to mess up insects. But what's the problem with this? If you start to spray ecdysone all over the trees, it's a steroid molecule, it's going to hang around, that's why they use ecdysone, because it hangs around. What's the problem with this? And they tried this out in Canada in an experimental situation, but it was a mess. So you spray ecdysone all over. Well, maybe some good insects you're zapping too, right? But then that ecdysone can wash off. It's a steroid molecule, it's pretty stable. Goes into the water supply. Now what did we hit? All the crustaceans. Not just the insects, but crustaceans. All arthropods pretty much use these same hormones. Juvenile hormone and ecdysone. So now we've messed up the whole ecological arena, right? And our wonderful favorite animal could be affected, right? Crayfish. And so actually crayfish use these same kind of processes as ecdysone as well. There's a different hormone for juvenile hormone, but ecdysone is still important. So I don't want you to memorize all the different processes, but just to think about ecdysone in alpha, beta form, and juvenile hormone that regulates these factors. Actually, what was kind of interesting is since we don't make ecdysone and we don't use ecdysone, pharmaceutical companies, one in Europe, was actually trying to use ecdysone in have ecdysone receptors in your genome because it's a steroid molecule. It goes in and works through a cytoplasmic receptor, right, and then it activates a region in your gene or in the animal's gene to then turn on, say, some synthesis. They were going to use ecdysone as a regulator for, like, gene therapy to give you ecdysone because you normally wouldn't have any effect on you. But, and then you could turn on, if you had a genetic sequence in your gene respond to the cytoplasmic receptor, then you could make a protein, for example, maybe use it to control diseases or help to make something. But they found out the ecdysone in mammals actually works on a potassium channel, and it doesn't, that's not good for activating potassium channels or blocking a potassium channel in your brain, right? Because steroids go right through the tissue. But it's an interesting concept. Use some insect hormones that we naturally don't have, we shouldn't have an effect, and then maybe we can regulate how our proteins are made or regulation. But then it became a bit of an issue. So there's this other PowerPoint that I have up under PowerPoints on your webpage called Endocrine Problems. I think it's too much to go through all the drugs and things like that, so don't pay attention to those. It's the kind of the main point. So I'm just going to flip through these. What it does is just re-emphasize what we've already talked about. Some of them. Questions? It's if you go to PowerPoints up on the top of the webpage and click go to PowerPoints, there's that part way down on the webpage that lists different PowerPoints. Over on the right-hand side, it says Endocrine 2. Okay. So we're just going to flip through this. We talked about growth hormone, right? So that's pretty interesting. Growth hormone, what it does, how is it regulated, where does it come from? Anterior pituitary, right? Overproduction, as we mentioned, like a tumor. There was a friend's wife in Toronto when I was up there, had a tumor in her anterior pituitary, so they had to actually go through it and remove it. I thought that was kind of interesting, so I chatted with her a lot about the problems that she had. Kind of interesting. Gigantism, where does this happen? If you're before puberty, right? If you had a growth hormone surge, you could then grow to, you know, very large. Like the basketball player from China, what's his name again? Yeah, so he's like this Lurch on the Monsters, the old movie. I know generation gap there. But anyways. But acromegaly is something different, but it's also too much growth hormone. Past puberty, what happens? Your epiphyseal plates stop growing, right? So your long bones don't grow anymore. So you're not going to grow any taller. But what's going to happen if you all of a sudden have a tumor or too much growth hormone at this point? All your tissues are growing in this body that's not changing, So now your heart enlarges too much, but your skeleton's not enlarging with it. So you have all these other problems. So you get this considered acromegaly after puberty if you have too much growth hormone. So it can be really a problem because they increase the cranial bone structure too. And so it's really a major problem for these people. So look at this person here, progression of acromegaly, young person, an adult person, there's the monsters. Right. And then a female, for example, that has acromegaly after puberty, you know, it can really change your whole structure. So they remove this. They actually used to go through the palate of the mouth up into the pituitary. Now they go through the nose, and they actually do this, you know, right over here, across the street as well. Interesting aspect. If you're in the clinics, for example, the nurse might be actually monitoring all the mucus that's coming out of the nose. And they actually look for differences. They'll actually test glucose in that to find out, is it actually cerebral spinal fluid or is it just mucus that's coming out? If it's just mucus coming out, like from the surgery, that's okay. But if they start to measure glucose levels, they know they're leaking cerebral spinal fluid too after the surgery. So it's really kind of interesting just using the glucose test after this. So they can actually go in there and do some stereotactic ways to get rid of it. They can use drug therapy too. I don't want you to memorize drugs, but just the idea, antagonist, you know, for this. Kind of neat. So here's an interesting question. I think we pulled this off of standardized exam a long time ago. So a person has acromegaly, right? They have too much growth hormone, kind of a pituitary problem. What might be some of these factors? And I know we didn't talk about somatolesions yet, but they were released to actually promote the growth of the tissue, and somatolesions are important. But you think about what other factors might happen. And it's really the somatolesions, because you can go through this kind of analogy, they're not going to have the negative feedback process, right? Because I've told you about the tumors usually are insensitive to the negative feedback. They're just producing. So they won't have that negative feedback, so it kind of eliminates these other choices that you have on there. It's kind of interesting. And if you ever had a glucose challenge to find out if you might be diabetic or something like that, you know, you have oral glucose, they take blood samples every so often for up to 4 hours, and you could actually have, you know, find out if you regulate your glucose levels or not. But they're not going to be sensitive to that test, right? Because they don't have the negative feedback. Hypofunction, hyperfunction, right? Hypo, too low, hyper, too much. So let's say we don't have our pituitary that's developing well. Think of all those hormones in the pituitary. What's going to happen? Lots of problems, right? Follicle-stimulating, luteinizing hormone, I mean, LH, all those kind of things. So it's really quite neat. And you might have an infarction. They call that Sheehan syndrome, you know, the blood vessel breaks there. Well, that tissue can die, and that could be a problem too, right? Lots of different factors are going to have a problem with this. Depends on the age, if it's before puberty, after puberty. Kind of shows the complexity of the whole system. So let's go through some of this. SIDA is an interesting aspect too. Overproduction of antidiuretic hormone. So what's going to happen if you have too much antidiuretic hormone? Antidiuretic, you're not peeing. What's going to happen to your blood pressure? It's going to go up, right? So you have a problem with this, and you might have too much of that being released, so then you can imagine the aspects that are going to happen. So increased water reabsorption, blood pressure, all those kind of fit together, right? Veterinarians have to worry about this with animals, too, so you can imagine how complex that is in the veterinarian field, all right? So that's really quite interesting as well. Same as like with humans. So the problems that can happen, you can imagine edema, right? Too much fluid around. Causes, lots of different causes that can happen. Tumors, for example, or inflammation sometimes. An infection can cause problems like a tumor. So really quite interesting. I don't want to go through the treatments. Now, you might have heard of diabetes in general. Usually we think about diabetes mellitus, right? With glucose levels. But there's also diabetes insipidus. So diabetes insipidus, which is not as common as diabetes mellitus or sugar, but diabetes insipidus is decreased production of ADH. So if you don't have ADH, or you decrease ADH, what's going to happen? A lot of urine production, right? And so you're peeing all the time, lots of urine. So now what's happened to blood pressure? Drops. What happens to your ionic regulation in your body? Big problem. So diabetes insipidus, sometimes that's on standardized exams and people check the glucose problems, and it's not with glucose, right? It's with water balance. So don't get confused with diabetes insipidus and diabetes mellitus with the deficient ADH production. Okay, so we can, you know, think about those. Thyroid gland disorders, if you have too much or too little, think about what's going to happen. We've talked about that kind of already. But if you don't have enough iodine in your diet, what happens to the tissue that's trying to make T3 and T4? It says, I'm not getting iodine. So let's increase the size of that tissue to try to grab more iodine out. And so you get these goiters. And this used to happen in America, too. Back in the pioneer days, when people went out west, they weren't getting the iodide that they had. And there were people with these kind of goiters that you can hear in old history books from pioneers that were getting it. Why don't we see that so much anymore in the States or in developed countries? Why don't we have
the iodine?
That's right, iodized table salt. Now you know why you have iodine on your table salt, right? That's pretty cool, but it's something we just take for granted. So that's really quite neat. People were thinking of actually putting iodine in drinking water and actually helping that out too, but that didn't go over very well. They just keep it with iodized salt. So you wouldn't have so much sodium is what they were trying to think about. But there's some other factors with too much iodine. So kind of neat to think about in, you know, thyroid margins. And as we mentioned, you know, could have, you can actually have an inflammation of that too, and that can cause problems. Thyroiditis, for example, right? Viral, bacterial, fungal infections. Kind of neat. Hyperthyroidism, we talked about the problems with the parathyroid glands too, right? Graves' disease is really quite interesting. Having too much of this problem as well. Excess thyroid, they just call it Graves' disease. Just think of everything we talked about. If you had too much thyroid hormone, and then you know, problems that actually build up fat behind your eyes too, and kind of makes your eyes protrude. So it's kind of interesting. Okay, let's go to the next one. Hypothyroidism, too low a thyroid. We talked about those problems, right? And that a lot of older people take Synthroid, synthetic thyroid. But here's a problem that can happen if it's early in development. You get what's not a dwarf; it's called a cretin. And a cretin doesn't develop. So look at this guy here. He's only 4 feet high. And he didn't develop secondary sexual characteristics very well. Lots of fat built up. Metabolism's not working right. But these are cretins, and there's some mental issues as well because the brain didn't develop. That's different than a dwarf, which has completely could have normal cognitive function, just that everything's reduced in size, maybe lower growth hormone, for example. So that's kind of interesting to think about. They actually check newborns for this problem so they can rectify it early on with treatments, right? So it's kind of neat to think about. All right. So you can imagine hyperthyroidism. You get skin problems too, dysmexidemia, and so that's really quite gross and some problems. Sorry. Adrenal cortex. Lots of issues with adrenal cortex. So we can kind of flip through these. Everything we've talked about generally already with these from the earlier point, but look through those PowerPoints and kind of think about problems that can happen. If you had too much or too little, the issues that can happen with it, like too much water, too much glucose. So you can flip through these kind of size things. Cushing syndrome, you've probably heard of. JFK had a problem with Addison's disease, too low of function from the adrenal cortex. Okay? So I think these are the same things that we've talked about generally. So flip through that and kind of get familiar with the general ideas. If you didn't pick up quiz number whatever that was on March 6th, I have a lot of people's quizzes in case you want these.